I'm Michaela Maguire, Artistic Director of Melbourne Writers Festival. You're listening to a conversation from our 2021 podcast series, which is supported by the Copyright Agency's Cultural Fund.
Hello, welcome to this Melbourne Writers Festival podcast. Let me be brief with Melissa Manning and Adam Thompson. I'd like to respectfully acknowledge that we're recording this conversation on unceded sovereign land. I'm speaking to you from the beulaful lands of the Boonwurrung people of the Kulin Nation, and I pay my respects to their elders past and present. I also acknowledge all First Nations people who are listening and pay respects to elders and traditional owners of wherever this podcast reaches you. My name is Veronica Sullivan. I'm the head of programming at the Wheeler Centre for Books, Writing and Ideas. But more importantly for this conversation, I'm a lover of short stories in general and of the two books that we're discussing today in particular. I'm joined by two wonderful writers to discuss their phenomenal short story collections, and I'll introduce you to them both now and invite them to tell us a little bit about their books. Melissa Manning is a Melbourne-based writer and lawyer. She grew up in southern Tasmania and has lived and worked in London and Hungary. Smokehouse is Melissa's debut collection and was shortlisted for the 2021 Steel Rudd Award for a short story collection in the Queensland Literary Awards. Hi, Melissa. Can you please tell us a little bit about Smokehouse?
Hi, Ronnie. Sure. It's lovely to be here. Look, Smokehouse is an interwoven story collection. It's bookended by a novella in two parts and set in southern Tasmania. And it's about the lives of the people in that community and the way their lives are shaped by where they live.
Beautiful. Thank you for that wonderful summary. And also joining us is Adam Thompson. Adam is an emerging Aboriginal Pakana writer from Tasmania who writes contemporary short fiction. Adam has been awarded a First Nations Fellowship at Varuna, several Arts Tasmania grants, and he was one of 10 inaugural recipients of the Next Chapter Scheme through the Wheeler Centre. Woo! His debut collection, Born Into This, was also shortlisted for the Steel Rudd Award and for the 2021 Age Book of the Year Award. Hi, Adam. Can you please give us a little summary of Born Into This?
Yeah, hi, Ronnie. So Born Into This is my debut book. It's a collection of short fiction. It's about 16 stories, all set in my home state of Lutruwita, which is Tasmania. It's contemporary and Aboriginal themed.
Beautiful. Thank you. So short story collections like Smokehouse and Born Into This are such a gift to those of us who've been stuck in lockdown for extended periods. Short stories are a great option for the fractured attention span that can necessitate, but also to be transported with these really vivid evocations of a more expansive, different environment than we may be experiencing within four walls is such a wonderful treat. And there are some commonalities between your books, but ultimately they are two very different works. They're both contemporary, realist, character-driven stories that are also deeply connected to their settings in various locations around Tasmania and surrounding islands. And so I'd like to start by talking about this most obvious commonality between your stories, arguably, which is their setting in Tasmania, and to ask you both about how you approach the writing of place. And I promise not to use the cliche of landscape as a character, but these books are both so deeply rooted in their Tasmanian settings, I can't really imagine reading them, you know, picked up and located somewhere else. So I'd love to ask you both how you go about writing this very distinct, very beautiful landscape, both the natural and human-made elements. And Melissa, I might start with you. You grew up in Tasmania and you're now living in Melbourne. Tell me a little bit about the setting for your stories in this very distinctive landscape south of Hobart, in and around the town of Kettering and on Bruny Island.
Yeah, that's right. I grew up in Tasmania, as you said, Ronnie, and for a couple of the years during my sort of early to mid-childhood, I lived in Kettering, and we did live on a property on the bay, and we did build a mud brick house. So something about that area and that period of my life that feels very seminal to who I've become. And I grew up also camping, all through my childhood, so I have a very deep connection to nature and an awareness, I suppose, of how small we are in the context of it.
Beautiful. And did you travel back to these locations while you were writing? You know, were you kind of, or is that memory of that childhood growing up there still so strong that it's a very present for you even now?
I've been back a number of times over the years and for extended periods, but I did do a return trip. In particular, I went down to Cockle Creek. But, you know, there was something about the memory that felt more real to me than the seeing of it now. And so I wanted to be true to that.
Yeah, beautiful. Adam, what about you? You live in Tassie, and I'd love to hear about your relationship to it as a place, and particularly as a writer, when you come to write about the landscape, the environment, the communities, the people of this place that you yourself live in.
Yeah, well, I've always lived here. I mean, I've spent, you know, a couple of years here and there travelling around different parts of Australia, but, you know, for most of my life I've lived in Tasmania. And I guess the, you know, my community that I'm writing about, I wanted the work to be really authentic and to be really capture the Tasmanian Aboriginal experience. So I didn't really have a choice about, you know, where the setting was. It had to be here. And, you know, people say to new writers like myself, you know, write about what you know, and Tasmania is what I know and my community. And so it's just happened really organically. There's some really unique locations in some of the stories, particularly on the islands in Bass Strait, that myself and my community have really important and long connections with some of these islands. And they're places that most people will never, ever get to go to. You know, they're quite remote. You know, they're Aboriginal owned, and they just won't, unlikely to ever get there. But these places are just fantastic. You know, they have so much history and heritage there, but often there's nobody living there anymore except the rangers that do the ranger work and the land management stuff. But there's foundations of the old buildings, and we know who lived there, and there's just so much history in those places, the old mutton bird sheds and that kind of thing. And so to be able to bring those places to the reader, I kind of feel is a gift to the reader, because, like I said, most people will never get there. And it certainly wasn't a kind of choice that I made to write about Tasmania. It just naturally happened. I don't have anywhere else to write about, really.
Yeah, certainly as a reader, it feels like such a gift. And when I mentioned that pleasure of being transported elsewhere, it's not a place that's familiar to me, but it feels so familiar, it feels so immediate in your writing of it, and particularly that awareness of past generations and the ways of living with the land, you know, caring for the land, hunting on it, all of that kind of human and environmental ecosystem. It's such a beautiful reading experience. I'm also interested in some of the stereotypical mainland conceptions of Tasmania, which often seem to exist on a dichotomy between these two extremes of a Gothic wild place, a convict island, and then perhaps more recently in the past decade or so, this holiday wonderland of food and culture and nature and, you know, going to have a slower paced life. And I don't want to reinforce these labels because I think they're quite reductive, but I'm interested in whether you seek to resist them when you're writing, or if you kind of prefer to just ignore them altogether and do your own thing. Melissa, maybe I'll start with you.
Yeah, it's an interesting question, Ronnie. I mean, I think that there's definitely a tendency either to denigrate what we see as a smaller way of living, or alternatively to romanticize it. But I think the reality is that Tasmania is just such a beautiful environment for a start. But also, your life is what you make of it wherever you live it, and your connection to the natural world and your connection to your community and the people who are close to you. I think those are the things that make life meaningful at the end of the day. And so I think, you know, these kind of, as you say, these, you know, ideals, or they're almost, some of them almost feel a bit like marketing strategies, don't they? They're not real. That's not what life's really like.
Mm. Adam, what about you?
Well, I guess I completely ignored them. I mean, I'm aware that there's those, you know, images of Tasmania and ways that people like to write about the place. But, you know, like I said earlier, you know, I come from a place of authenticity, and I'm trying to create work that's authentic about my community and this place. So, you know, really I'm just writing from experience. I'm not trying to put a gloss on it or a sheen or anything like that. I'm just writing from what I know. And so really I just ignore that and wrote the Tasmania that I'm familiar with.
Mm. Authenticity is a word that I have come back to many times in thinking about both of your books, and in relation to the characters as well. Your characters are so memorable, and they also feel really authentic and really human, which as a reader, you know, I think so many readers, and particularly I certainly feel this, that's what you want, is you want to connect with other experiences and other people through fiction. And even in a few pages, you can bring us right into their lives, even just for a brief period, and the reader is right there. And I'm thinking, Melissa, I'm thinking about your stories, which many of the central section, that the stories are quite short, and the characters, as you mentioned earlier, kind of weave through the stories. They might pop up here or there or briefly appear, but then they disappear, and the ways that they connect to one another isn't necessarily apparent until you step back and look at the entire collection as a whole. And there's just an example of one character who really stuck with me is this woman, Agnes, this really tough but caring older woman who only appears quite briefly, but she's so indelible, and she has a really significant impact on the other characters. And Adam, I'm thinking of a character like Dorothy in your story, Descendant, who is this lonely teenage girl who's so proud of her Aboriginal heritage. And then the mean girls at school begin to claim that they also have Aboriginal heritage, and she's devastated and quite furious. And it's, even though she's a kind of a pain, I just wanted to give her a hug. It's a really, and that's such an affecting window into the politics of teenage girls, which I maintain is one of the scariest things in the world. So I'd love to, you know, those are just some of my favorite examples, but I'd love to hear from each of you what engages you with your characters and how you decide to write about them and to explore particularly these brief slices that we get, that is the pleasure and the joy of short stories often, when we are having these glimpses and these moments of immersion. What draws you to them? And Melissa, maybe I'll start with you again.
Sure, yeah, look, I don't ever plan my characters, and I think probably that's true for most writers, but they appear in a snippet or a moment or a kind of some vague idea. And I suppose what draws me to them is that I don't know what's going to happen to them, and I don't know where their lives are going to take them. And I might have some ideas for where they might go or what might happen, but invariably when I sit down to write, those are not the things that happen in their life. Mm. And I suppose that's interesting to me because that's how we experience life. And, you know, and the connections that characters have with one another often are quite random, and then, you know, people who are important to you at one stage in your life may slip out of your life for a long time and then pop up again somewhere else in a completely different context. And so I suppose I feel for the characters because for me they're real people. You know, they're people that I know or that I've known, which is not to say that they're based on real people, but they've become real people to me through the writing of the stories.
They certainly feel real, and I'm curious about that reference point of the town that you grew up in and around, and that you know this community, whether the character types, you know, obviously they're not real people, but are you working with types that were familiar to you from living within that community?
Actually, not at all. I mean, I was probably 8 when, or 9, but, you know, I lived there for two and a half years from when I was 8. So the memory that I have is kind of quite vague in terms of experience. It's more about that sense of what it was like to live in that place, to run on that earth, to look at that view, to smell the trees in that place. Yeah, so it's really more that. It's not at all based on particular people or my knowledge of particular people who may have lived there.
Beautiful. Adam, what about you? Tell me about characters and how they find their ways into your stories and how you find your way to these particular points in their lives for your stories.
Yeah, well, my answer is kind of similar to Melissa's, I suppose. You know, you create a character and then you think you have an idea for them in the story, but they, you know, they have a mind of their own and, you know, they make their own story. There's some instances where, you know, you need to have qualities in the character that will drive, you know, drive your plot and perhaps bring out some of the themes that you want to explore. So, you know, you kind of need to do that as well. And, you know, in a short story, you don't have a lot of time and space to develop your character. So I think, you know, in the short form, you know, you really kind of have to nail it and you have to bring out their qualities quite early in the story. But, you know, I think, you know, in a way, like some of the characters that I create have qualities that are similar to people in my community or people that I know. I mean, as writers, you know, we're kind of stealing from everything, aren't we? I mean, we can't just create things completely out of thin air. Like everything's based on our experiences in some way. So definitely, you know, my characters share qualities with people in my community, but I haven't based them on anyone. So that's my, you know, my waiver from getting sued. Look, I think it's been interesting, you know, reading the feedback from my community about the characters in my stories, because they'll come up to me and they say, oh, this character is such and such, isn't it? Or, you know, that reminds me so much of this person. And I kind of smile to myself, because in ways, after I've written the character in the story, I guess I do see those similarities, but it's not on purpose. And in many ways too, like there's aspects of the characters that are myself, but very differently, you know, like you spoke about Dorothy, who's this high school girl. I mean, she's not me, but I've shared some of her experiences. And I've shared experiences with all of my characters, and I guess they're all some part of me in a way, but at the same time that they're their own people.
You mentioned some of the responses that you've had from readers and from community members or friends who've read the book and seen themselves. I'm interested to know what you have hoped that your readers would take from the stories. Both Aboriginal and non-Aboriginal readers, and because there are so many really acute interactions between Aboriginal and non-Aboriginal characters, and often those interactions in the stories are points of friction or points of turning or points of recognising or not recognising one another. So I'm very interested in how readers have responded and kind of how you were hoping they might respond, and whether anything about that has surprised you.
Well, I think what surprised me the most is that I haven't had very much negative feedback, because my work is, some of it's kind of crazy, you know. It's not, you know, the reactions of my characters are quite extreme at times, and also what I write about is kind of political, and I thought that I'd have a lot of haters, to be honest. I thought that some people in my community would think that I haven't represented us accurately, perhaps, because of some of those extreme, you know, scenarios in the stories. But people have really, really embraced it in my community, and I think that's fantastic. And the feedback that I get from non-Aboriginal people is one of like a humbleness of feeling like they've been brought into something and they're learning something new for the first time, like they're seeing a really authentic experience. And so, you know, it's been really great feedback, and I'm really grateful for that, because I was kind of bracing myself for a bit of hate, but it's been really good.
That's fantastic. Maybe it's just that the stories are really great, and that's why you're not getting any negative blowback. I think when you've put that work in and you have created something that is generous and authentic and, you know, beautifully written, everyone can appreciate and be grateful for that.
I've been accused of it not being fiction. A couple of people said, "Oh no, the characters are too real. That's not fiction." I think that I took that as a compliment. I think, well, if people are seeing the characters as real to life, then I've done a good job in their development.
Absolutely, and in fact, you mentioned just before that, you know, that you were often seeking to draw out themes in your stories through those characters and kind of might need to maneuver the character or you know, have them be in a certain situation in order to address a theme. And they are very political stories often, or they're engaged with politics and with topical issues, particularly around class, race, environmental issues. I think you utilise those real world topics really powerfully to pack a punch for the reader. How do you go about bringing those real world issues in without being didactic or heavy-handed or detracting from telling a good story?
Well, the I guess the best answer I have for that is that I come from a place of storytelling first. Mm. You know, it's my goal to tell a good yarn and to entertain the reader, you know, because I like to read stories and I like a story to make me feel something, and I want to make the reader feel something. But because of the nature of the work that I've done, you know, I worked at the Tasmanian Aboriginal Centre for almost 20 years. You know, it's very political, you know, and because you're part of the community, you know, you bring that stuff home as well. So it's not just, you know, in your day job that you're experiencing this stuff and, you know, battling, trying to pursue the interests of your community and get a better deal. But it's when you go home too, because you're part of the community, you can't just switch off. Mm. So because of that, you know, this stuff is in your mind all the time, this, you know, trying to protect our heritage and, you know, uphold the authenticity of our community. And so that stuff just naturally creeps into the work, you know, and often it's not a matter of, you know, me kind of going, okay, I want to write a story about racism. How do I weave the characters into that? It's the opposite. It's you know, I want to write this engaging yarn about this person experiencing this thing. Mm. But then, of course, this stuff that's in my brain that's happening during the day that's kind of, you know, that's just, it just comes out into the story.
Mm.
So I think a way of it not coming across didactic is that, coming from a place of storytelling first and then kind of weaving those themes into it as you go.
Yeah, absolutely. It's not just politics, it's life. They're not extricable neatly, nor should they be. Melissa, I'd like to talk to you about the emotional terrain that you cover, and some of it is quite devastating. I found as a reader, you know, there's some really hard experiences and fractures. We see a couple whose relationship is destroyed by their only daughter's addiction, and a young girl whose family dies in a tsunami in Japan while she's on exchange in Tasmania. A man grieving the sudden death of his soulmate, a woman in denial of her husband's decline to Alzheimer's. It can be very heavy territory to traverse. And I hope I'm not making it sound too depressing, because it's also beautifully woven through with love and tenderness. I think the reason that so many of these dynamics have such an impact is because you are also conveying often years of deep joy that precedes a loss or a fracture. And it wouldn't be so painful if there wasn't something special there to lose. So it's a good kind of ache. And I would love to know how you go about balancing those really sad or bruising experiences with keeping the joy present in the story for the characters and for the reader?
Yeah, look, I think that the characters lead it themselves to a large extent. I suppose what I'm mindful of when I'm writing is that life isn't black and white in terms of our emotional scale, and happiness isn't kind of an end game. It's happiness is moments of joy peppered throughout our lives, and can actually be experienced while you're quite deep in grief or trauma. I think there's this really strange idea in Western society that we need to strive for happiness, and that the crappy things, yeah, they might happen here or there, but mostly they'll happen to other people. And if you're a decent person, they probably won't happen to you. And it's just not a reflection of reality. So firstly, I wanted to honour that in my character stories, because I think that's the truth of people and the truth of living. But I always hope to convey enough of the joy. And as you say, there's no loss if you haven't had something to lose. So to give the reader a real sense of the quality of the friendships and the relationships and the nuances and the even whether a relationship's breaking down, that it's not one person's fault or the other person's fault, you know, necessarily. It's just expectations don't fit, or, you know, things change, people change.
Yes, and as you say, you know, ironically, if you're always searching for, expecting or striving for some kind of perfectly attained state of happiness, you'll never be able to just sit with what you have and appreciate and enjoy that in the moment.
I think that's right. I mean, that's a recipe for unhappiness, surely.
Absolutely. I'd like to ask you both a little bit about structure and craft. Adam, I will start with you, and I want to talk to you about humour, yeah, like kind of the sharp, wry humour that your stories have. It's often quite subtle, and I feel like it kind of sneaks up on you, but then it's very enjoyable because it's so clever. And there's also a real measure of irony in your work often. And often a twist at the end of the story, sometimes a violent one. We have in the story Honey, there's a really obnoxious antagonist who's, spoiler, swarmed by bees at the end of the story. And in Kite, a poodle is speared by a kite with the Aboriginal flag on it on the beach on Australia Day. And I think that would have been very traumatic for me as a reader if it was a different breed of dog, but no offence to poodles. Can you tell me about some of these endings and how you find that perfect little unexpected zap of sourness to leave the reader with it as they finish the story?
That's a good question, Ronnie. Basically I write what I like to read, and I like reading stories like that. I love twisted endings. I love it when you finish a short story and you kind of think, I think I know how that ends. I think I get that, but you're not really quite sure, and perhaps you have to go back and read the last page again. You know, I like that. I think that's a cool experience. I like it when I'm thinking about the story for a long time afterwards, and I think that's the mark of a good short story. And if it makes you feel something, if it plays with your emotions. But, you know, I mean, all stories come about differently. Like with that story, Kite, you know, I guess – you know, I was down at Greens Beach, which is not far from where I live, and I seen these. It was a windy day, and I was here with my family, and I seen these people flying these kites, and there was this annoying dog just kind of running around and not, you know, jumping on everybody and scratching little kids, and you know, this kite was moving really erratically in the sky, and I'm kind of thinking, well, what would happen if the kite came down and hit the dog, and you know, and then I just thought, okay, cool, that's something I could write a short story about, and so I guess with that story, I had the ending in mind before anything else came together. Mm. I wanted to tell a cool yarn about that, and then I thought, well, it'd be good if it happened at Australia Day, and you know, because I'm very passionate about changing the date. So all the stories come together differently, and I like it. I like an extreme ending. In fact, I had to tame some of my endings. You know, I've worked with a mentor. I've worked with Kate Gordon and Kate Kennedy and some of the stories. And, you know, they've kind of had to tame some of the endings down a little bit. Some of them were a little bit too extreme. But I guess that's all the part of the refining process of, you know, working with editors and mentors. And I think, you know, humour, I mean, it opens people up. And I think that the more people are immersed in the story and engaged in it, then the better effect you're going to have with what you're presenting them. And especially when you're presenting issues that you kind of want to educate people about, like I am, you know. I think people become sensitized to, you know, issues and themes when they're presented through mainstream media and things like that. An example might be, you know, the way that the Greens used to be in the media, up in the trees all the time, and people just see that and they just, you know, their eyes glaze over and they just flick over the channel. You know, they've seen it so much that they don't really care about it anymore. And I think that if you're presenting some of these issues through a short story in an entertaining way, people have their guard down, there's a little bit of humour, a little bit of, you know, feeling in there, and then they kind of get a little bit of an education and probably don't even realise it because they've done it, they've experienced it on their own terms. So, you know, I think that, you know, having all of those qualities in the stories just adds to the effect of it, yeah.
And you're often leaving us with such distinct images as well. It's kind of this after image that lingers with you of, you know, whatever it might be, the dog with the kite in it, it's still present. And in this kind of, as you say, this like saturated landscape where we're being bombarded by really strong messages all the time, having something so distinctive and so unusual really leaves a mark with you.
Yeah, and I like to be a little bit crazy. Like, you know, I like my work to have that element of kind of, you know, surprise, and, you know, people are kind of thinking, oh, well, you know, Adam Thompson's work's a little bit out there. What's going to happen in this story? I guess it creates a bit of anticipation as well. And, yeah, that's just my signature, I suppose.
So what was too extreme that you were advised to tone it down by your mentors? Was it too dramatic or too unbelievable? What was the change there?
Well, often I probably would have changed the ending anyway. Like that story Descendant about, you know, Dorothy, and that the whole story is a metaphor for, I guess, what's happening with Aboriginality in Tasmania, where institutions are imposing themselves on the community and saying, we're the ones that decide who's Aboriginal and who's not, not you, the community. And at the end of that story, don't want to spoil it too much for the listeners, but, you know, Dorothy, you know, faints and comes to. But in my original first draft, you know, she's holding that girl down and pokes her eyes out with her thumbs because she's so angry that, you know, this girl's come in and claimed to be Aboriginal, has spilled stuff on her computer, and it's just sent her over the edge, you know. And I would have changed that anyway, but my mentor got in quickly and said, no, that's probably a little bit too extreme. And so I've reworked the ending, and it's much better now, of course. But I guess because I feel so strongly about that issue, and because I like to have a bit of a crazy, you know, twist in my stories, that at first that seemed cool, but perhaps it was a little bit too extreme.
Definitely more extreme. I don't know if it's too extreme. Who can say? Well, you can say. You're the writer. Melissa, I'd love to talk to you about structure as well. Smokehouse has quite an unusual structure, being bookended by two long stories, Smokehouse Part 1 and Smokehouse Part 2, which are connected. And together those are longer than all the other stories put together. But then we have these short stories in the middle that are all connected to one another and to that opening and closing section within that same community. I'm probably making it sound more complicated than it is. It's actually very effortless to read, and you do get that sort of satisfying feeling as a reader when you go, oh, I remember that character, they've popped up again, and I'm seeing how this network kind of fits together, this, you know, the network of a community. Can you tell us, how much work was that to craft? Because it does feel very organic as it unspools as a reader.
It was actually an enormous amount of work, and it wasn't by design. So the novella that bookends the collection in two parts was originally one part of a dual narrative novel, which I flogged and flogged and flogged and refused to admit it was dead for a really long time before I had to admit it. So I pulled those two apart and did a lot more work on the novella, but I kept becoming quite interested in other characters who weren't necessarily central to the novella. And so I wrote a number of short stories, and as that progressed, it started to feel like the right way to do it. There were a couple of publishers who were interested in the collection originally, but they wanted me to turn it into a novel. And I didn't feel that I could do that without losing some of the people who I really loved and who I felt were really quite important to the threads that I'd woven together to actually give a picture of the community and the way that the lives of these characters interacted. So, but the mapping process to actually get all those stories to work together was crazy. You know, map tables of who was born when, who met who when, all of the you know, the initial interactions and the key interactions, and I had to do a lot of editing to actually make that work. But you know, it was satisfying in the end, but a brutal process to write through.
I can imagine. It's very satisfying to read, but no, that makes a lot of sense, and that's so fascinating. But not surprising that you had publishers pushing you towards reframing as a novel. I think we are all very aware that short stories, historically, you know, in the past couple of decades, maybe it's changing a little bit, but have been considered not particularly marketable, particularly for debut writers. And there are some publishers that really buck that, and I would say UQP, who publishes you both, is a fantastic example of that and have been great champions of short stories for a long time. But certainly there are other publishers for whom a short story collection is harder for them to sell, or they think it's going to be harder to sell than a novel would be. And I could absolutely see a version of Smokehouse that wouldn't even need to be that different necessarily to be badged as a novel. And you know, there are novels in stories that are linked. Elizabeth Strout's Olive Kitteridge is probably the most obvious example of a book of that nature.
I think that's right. I mean, it has been described as a novel in mosaic as well. Mm. So, but what I like about it is that you can dip in and read any of the stories discreetly. So I guess you can consume it the way that you like to as a reader.
That's a beautiful term, novel in mosaic. And that's a beautiful way to lead to my penultimate question, which is, to ask you both, given that you are each making such excellent and meaningful use of this short form, what it is about short stories that you most love, and maybe what most challenges you?
Oh, well, you know, I mean, I love short stories. I like that you don't have to invest as much time in it as you do a novel. I like that it has a lot of impact. I think that, you know, As a writer of short stories, you can get away with having kind of crazy endings and ambiguous endings because the reader doesn't invest so much time in it. You know, when you read a novel, you kind of really expect everything to be resolved well, and you've spent, you know, days or weeks reading it. But a short story, you can get away with that, and I think that that gives you, as a writer, more fun to have with the form. I like that you read it in a single sitting, and I think that you know, you're not breaking out of it like you do a novel. So you know, you're fully immersed in that story from beginning to end. So you're in that kind of continual fictional dream for that whole time. Mm-hmm. I think there's a real power to that in storytelling, just keeping somebody in that space. But then there's a challenge there of being able to write in a way that doesn't break people out of the story. There's nothing jarring in there. You know, I think you should use simple language you know, and have a good knowledge of that craft. It is challenging to write in terms of being efficient in your writing. You know, you kind of have to be, you got to stick to the story, and you can't kind of go off on tangents. But it's a great form, and I think that it's going to become more popular. I think just with the way people are with their attention spans these days, with the internet and binge television, I think that people are going to be kind of moving towards more short stories. I think there's room for that. That's it for me.
Beautiful. What about you, Melissa?
Yeah, like Adam, I enjoy the fact that you can read a short story in a single sitting. And one of the things that I like about that is that it's easy to come back to a short story that you've loved. It's a much bigger undertaking to come back to a novel that you've enjoyed when you've got a pile, you know, yay high next to your bed and everywhere else in your house. From a writing perspective, I like it for a few reasons. I think it forces you to be very judicious about the choices of words. So it's a really great way to hone your craft, I think, and to distill your story to the point of absolute clarity. For me, it's, and I think you've got more freedom. I agree with Adam. You've got some freedom to play around a little bit more and have the reader stick with you through that, where they might not, if you're playing around to that extent with a novel length form. And I do particularly like, story collections that are themed or are linked in some way.
Mm. And perhaps to finish up on that note, I'd love if you could both share just maybe a couple of short fiction writers that you most admire or enjoy. It could be your writers that have influenced you or just that are your favourites. Go, Melissa, who kind of comes to mind for you in your pantheon of amazing short fiction writers?
I have a list as long as my arm, and many of them are Australian. I think that there are some extraordinary writers of the short story form in Australia. It's great to see. Probably, you know, some of my top would be Jennifer Down. Her Pulse Points collection is excellent. Josephine Rose, Here Until August. I love Tony Birch's short story work, in particular his Father's Day collection, which is quite old now. For something a bit quirkier, I really enjoyed Chloe Wilson's Hold Your Fire and Wayne Marshall's Shirl. And obviously I'm, you know, virtually here in the room with Adam, who's written a fantastic collection, and I'm a very big fan of that too.
Beautiful. What about you, Adam?
Well, I was going to say Melissa Manning because I really, really rate Melissa's work. You know, I think it's top notch, and when I read it, it makes me feel bad about my own work. And I was really looking forward to catching up at the Melbourne Writers Festival with you, Melissa, and we will get to someday. I like Tony Birch, and I hate this question too, Ronnie. Sorry, because I always feel like I'm missing people out, and I always do. So I apologise to anyone I've missed out. I love so many different, you know, writers, but yeah, look, I love Tony's work, Tony Birch, Ellen Van Nieuwen. I really like Elizabeth Tan's short stories, Michaela Saunders. Tim Winton's short fiction is fantastic. I love Kate Kennedy, and she's been a mentor of mine, and I just love her short fiction. Growing up, you know, read a lot of American stuff like Poe and Lovecraft, Ray Bradbury, J.D. Salinger, Raven Carver and Kurt Vonnegut. I really like Stephen King's short fiction, and I like James Salter as well. And Wells Tower came out with a great short story collection called Everything Ravaged, Everything Burned, and I thought that was fantastic as well. But, look, I love short fiction, and I've probably missed out heaps of people, but, yeah.
That's a pretty phenomenal list to start with, at the very least, and a wonderful note to end on. Thank you so much to these two brilliant authors for joining me today, Adam Thompson and Melissa Manning. Thank you both for sharing such generous insights into your beautiful books. And to everyone listening, you can buy Adam and Melissa's books. Adam's is Born Into This and Melissa's is Smokehouse. They're available through MWF's Partner Bookshop Readings. Thank you for supporting Melbourne Writers Festival and for joining us today for Let Me Be Brief.
Thanks, Ronnie, and thanks, Melissa.
Thanks, Ronnie. Thanks, Adam.
Thanks for listening. To support Melbourne Writers Festival, you can make a donation of any size at mwf.com.au.